ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey there, Sana Qadar here from All in the Mind. Check out our new series, Forensic. It's all about the psychological tools and tricks that come with investigating crime.
He was setting the bombs off in subways, in the New York Public Library, in movie theaters.
When you're testifying in court, rather than having purely your own memory, you take on all these little bits and pieces of information from different sources.
All in the Mind, Forensic. Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello from David Rutledge. Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone here on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen. Great to have you along this week for a discussion about an issue in Buddhist philosophy that is both absolutely central and somewhat mysterious, certainly difficult to pin down. And it's something that Buddhist scholars have been arguing about pretty much since Buddhism got started way back in the 5th century BCE. The issue has to do with the self and what it means to claim, as Buddhist doctrine does, that there is no self. In Buddhist philosophy, what we call a person is really just an ever-shifting bundle of physical and mental processes with no permanent identity. There's no you or me behind those processes. The thinkers of the Abhidhamma tradition, which dates from around the 3rd century BCE, developed this insight into a detailed philosophical system that analyzes human experience into momentary events rather than enduring substances. Philosophers such as the 4th century Indian Buddhist monk Vasubandhu argued that the self is something we project onto this flowing process. So that approach to the self is known as reductionism. It reduces the person to its more basic constituents or aggregates. But at the same time, Buddhism doesn't say that people are simply not real. And that's just as well, because reducing the self to a dynamic play of impressions and experiences and mental and physical states leaves a lot of important questions unanswered. Who is it that has these experiences? Who is it that can be said to be responsible for actions in the world? And if you subscribe to the doctrine of rebirth, who is it that's reborn? Well, one way of approaching these questions comes in the form of what's known as emergentism. That's a later development in Buddhist philosophy that sees the self as more than just the interaction of its aggregate parts. Emergentists believe that there's something to the self that resists reductionism, in the way that there's something about an ocean wave that can't be reduced to the simple presence of water molecules. Well, I'm talking about all of this today with Bronwyn Finnegan, who's an associate professor in the School of Philosophy at the Australian National University in Canberra. Bronwyn recently gave a seminar at the University of Sydney on this dispute between reductionism and emergentism in Buddhist philosophy. Now, if I were to stop random people in the street and ask them to tell me one key Buddhist principle, I would imagine that a lot of those people would mention the teaching of non-self, this famous Buddhist claim that there is no self, the self is an illusion. It's a well-known doctrine, but what's interesting and maybe not so well-known is that Buddhists themselves don't agree on what that means. So before we get into it, what's at stake here? Like, why is this an important question, this question of the self and what it means to say that it doesn't exist?
Yeah, so the Buddha's claim that there's no self was controversial from the very beginning, and it gave rise to a range of different interpretations within Buddhism. So yeah, it's not well recognized that Buddhist philosophers didn't all agree on what it meant. But what's at stake is it's not just a matter of interpretation, but you know, how we understand persons generally. So if there's no self, we still need to explain continuity over time, agency, moral responsibility. And in the Buddhist context, we need to explain karma and rebirth. But as Buddhist philosophers tried to answer these questions, their debates quickly move from questions about self to more complex issues like the nature of causation or how complex systems are organized. And it's these kind of issues that my current research is really focused on.
Right. Well, that's a nice overview of everything we're about to get into over the next half hour or so, which is great. But you've described two broad approaches to the question of non-self, and they're what's known as reductionist views and emergentist views. So before we get into the details of each one, What's the importance of the disagreements between those two positions?
Yeah, so what's at stake in their disagreement is how we explain the organization of persons. So the reductionist view develops the idea that persons can be analyzed into changing physical and psychological processes. These processes are impermanent, they arise and cease, and they causally depend on each other. There is no essential self that persists unchanging through time that unifies them all as the same person. But on this view, we can still talk about a person as real, but in a conventional sense, as a convenient way of talking about these more complex causally interacting processes. They're not ultimately real in their own right. Now, the emergentists, they agree these processes are real, but they argue they're not enough to explain person-level features like agency. So on their view, persons are relational structures that depend on these underlying processes but are not reducible to them. So the core issue is whether features like agency can be explained in terms of simpler processes or whether we need to assume some kind of higher-level structure to explain them.
If we break it down a bit, the reductionist view of the self, first of all, why do we call it the reductionist view? I mean, I think there's something sort of in that name. It has to do with what Buddhism calls the aggregates. Can you speak to that a bit?
Yeah, so Buddha uses this term skanda or aggregate to refer to physical and psychological elements. So there's, on the Buddha's analysis, there are five types. There's physical processes or elements, there's elements of feeling, of consciousness, of cognitive factors like perception and cognition, volitional formations like intentions and emotions. And in these traditions that we're talking about, they take this to be exhaustive. There's nothing else to a person than these five kinds of aggregates, these kind of psychological and physical processes. The reductionist view, it's the most developed contemporary interpretation of what this view amounts to. And it's developing a view that comes from a tradition called Sautrantika Abhidharma. And it's a little bit different to more familiar kinds of reductions. So reductionism in contemporary philosophy tends to talk about how we reduce mental events to physical events. Within Buddhist reductionism, both mental events and physical events are both treated as ultimately real. And a Buddhist reductionism also appeals to a distinction between two levels of truth. So at one level, it's correct to say persons exist and they act in the world, but at a more fundamental level of analysis, what's really ultimately real are these causally connected processes. So we can say that persons are real in a conventional sense, but they're not ultimately real. Now, reductionism come up with some criteria for what counts as ultimately real. So broadly speaking, something counts as ultimately real if it's irreducible. You can't analyze it into more basic constituents. It's got its own kind of intrinsic nature or intrinsic characteristic that distinguishes it from other things. And it's sufficiently distinct to be causally dependent and to function as a cause and condition of other ultimately real things. And it's momentary. It arises and ceases, but doesn't persist unchanging through time. And so this criteria already sort of puts some pressure on the idea that a relational structure could be ultimately real. And, you know, as early as in the 4th century, a Buddhist philosopher called Vasubandhu puts pressure on this idea. He's like, well, if a relational structure depends on the processes that it's relating, it's a bit hard to say how it could be distinct and causally efficacious in its own right to count as an ultimately real entity. So the question for the emergentist is, well, what do they mean by this relational structure being real? Like, what sense of reality are we talking about here? And how does it relate to the underlying processes if it's not a distinct, causally independent thing?
You mentioned emergentism there, and this is the other understanding of the self that we see in Buddhist philosophy. This is emergentism. What claims does an emergentist account of the self typically make?
Yeah, so what we are calling emergentism is the view that some scholars are attributing to a Buddhist tradition called Pudgalavada. Now, this view holds that persons are real, but they're neither separate to nor distinct from underlying processes, but they depend on them. Now, this combination of claims is really hard to make sense of. I mean, if something's neither separate nor distinct, there's not a lot of obvious logical space there
yes,
for it to
right.
be. But one way of trying to understand it might be as a relational structure. And this is a proposal by Amber Carpenter. So a relational structure, it's not distinct from the things it relates. I mean, it's a relation of those things. It's also not identical to them. Otherwise, it's just the things. But you might also say it depends on them, because if those things weren't there, there'd be no relational structure of them. So I think this is quite a plausible way of trying to think through what kind of claim this school is trying to make. But the challenge for this view is to explain, well, what kind of dependence relation are we talking about between this relational structure and the aggregates, the underlying processes? If it's a causal relation, then the reductionist can say, well, it has to be a distinct thing because causes precede their effects and so must be distinct from them. If it's fully dependent on those underlying processes, then you might wonder, why is this not just a convenient way of describing their causal activity? Why attribute it any reality sense at all? So the pressure for this position is to try to explain the dependence relation that it thinks is in play. It's got to be strong enough for the person to be real in some sense, but not so strong that it becomes a distinct entity with its own causal powers. And, you know, in contemporary terms, we might also ask, well, how does this count as a form of emergentism? It's resisting a reduction, but it's not giving full causal autonomy to the structure. Now, defenders of this view tend to say, well, look, the reductionist criteria of ultimate reality is too restrictive. I mean, persons are real, but the idea of ultimate reality or conventional reality, neither of them properly capture this sense of reality. And historically, proponents of the reductionist approach sort of say, well, the burden of proof is on you guys to explain what sense of reality we've got left over. And, you know, we don't really find a well-developed account. And unfortunately, we've lost a lot of the philosophical texts from this tradition. So we don't really know how they developed it in a positive sense.
Mm.
But some contemporary defenders, such as Carpenter, developed this position further. So they agree that, the criteria of ultimate reality that reductionism assumes is too restrictive. But they also develop a line of sort of critical argument. They argue that, well, the reductionists rely on the idea of a relational structure, in particular when they appeal to the notion of a causal series to answer challenges to their view. So they assume the very structure that they deny. So this is a form of circularity. But another problem they raise is if they don't acknowledge this structure, it looks like they can't explain the kind of functional capacities that we attribute to persons like agency. So this is an explanatory insufficiency objection. So we've got two challenges here. One is a circularity objection, and one is this sort of explanatory insufficiency objection. Even if we can get around this claim that you're presupposing what you're denying, you still don't have enough in your theory to explain the kinds of phenomena that we really want to capture in an account of persons.
The reductionist view explains the self as not just a bunch of aggregates. I mean, we've talked about the aggregates, you know, body, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. The reductionist view sees these as being arranged in a causal series. And I find that really interesting. What does this idea of a causal series mean, and what problem is it meant to solve?
Yeah, that's a great question. Traditional reductionists held that what's ultimately real is momentary. But a lot of the phenomena that's central to personal identity involves continuity over time. I mean, for example, you know, how do we explain how a Buddha has stable dispositions like wisdom and compassion? And how do we account for karma and rebirth? And how do we account for recollection if the past experience doesn't exist when it's recollected? And how do we account for the fact that, you know, distinct individuals can't remember each other's past experiences? A huge number of questions arise from this assumption that what exists is only momentary. And traditional reductionists like Vasubandhu replied to this by saying, well, look, we can explain this by appeal to a causal continuity. What links these momentary events is that they form a causal series. So he says, what we mean by the Buddha just refers to a series of psychological and physical processes. Rebirth is just the continuation of this series. We can explain recollection because it's a sequence of events within a series. People can't remember each other's, what they had for breakfast because they're, you know, psychological, physical processes are not sufficiently causally connected. So this idea of a causal series does a lot of explanatory work within the reductionist account. And in a really interesting and excellent article, Amber Carpenter raises some problems for this. And one problem is, well, look, you guys are referring to a causal series all the time. This kind of looks like you're assuming a causal relational structure. I mean, it looks like you might be assuming exactly what you're denying.
Mm.
So this is the circularity
objection. The circularity objection, yeah.
But then she also argues that, and even if you can get around this, if you don't acknowledge this structure, then you're not going to be able to explain things like agency. Although I think that this question about agency is kind of the tougher one, and maybe we'll get to it, maybe we won't, I think the reductionists can deal with this circularity objection. I think they can deal with it if they draw on some resources from this 4th century philosopher Vasubandhu, who holds an idea of causal inference grounded in experience to try to account for why it's okay that he can appeal to a causal series without presupposing that it ultimately exists.
Tell me more about that. I mean, what do you mean by a causal inference?
Yeah, so he has this really interesting idea. He thinks, look, we don't directly perceive ultimately real entities, and we don't perceive causal relations between them. What we are aware of are the representations they cause to arise in our conscious awareness. So we observe that there's a certain reliable following between one event arising and something else occurring. When one thing is absent, certain other things don't follow. And so we form inferences about causal connections based on these regularities in representations in our experience. These causal inferences are justified because, on his view, they're generated by really causally efficacious processes. The causal powers of the underlying processes generate the representations we have in our experience, and that allows us to form and test predictions about what's likely to happen in suitable circumstances. But this doesn't require us to assume that these underlying processes really form these patterns in the same way. I mean, the patterns are there in how we represent these processes, but they're not necessarily the way they're structured in ultimate reality. But at the same time, because they're generated by really causally efficacious processes, our inferences are not arbitrary. We can test them by prediction and observation. So when a reductionist appeals to this notion of a causal series, it's not assuming some additional layer of structure. It's making a causal inference. It's a conceptual abstraction that organizes our experience of regularities in a way that supports prediction and explanation. So, you know, in appealing to a causal series, I think a reductionist can say, look, I'm not assuming a real relational structure. I am making a justified causal inference. And so this circularity objection falls flat.
On ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, you're listening to The Philosopher's Zone. I'm David Rutledge, and this week I'm speaking with Bronwyn Finnegan, who's a scholar of Buddhist philosophy at the Australian National University in Canberra. We're getting deep into a vexed question in Buddhist scholarship, which has to do with the doctrine of non-self. It's all very well to say, as Buddhists often do, that the self is an illusion, but exactly what that means is the subject of a lot of debate. For example, in ethics, if myself doesn't really exist, then how can I be held responsible for that bank I robbed yesterday? We're talking about the two main schools of Buddhist thought on this. Reductionism, that says that the self is just a bundle of sensations and perceptions, and emergentism, that says, yes, those sensations and perceptions exist, but there is still a person, a self, that emerges from them. There's a common tendency to think of the thread of someone's life as being a deeply personal thing. But actually, on the reductionist view, it seems like that thread is causal rather than personal. And so things like memories, are these just sort of later moments being shaped by earlier ones? Is that the best way to understand memory?
Yeah, no, that's exactly how they think of it. Mm. There's a past experience in suitable conditions, such as when there's attention, can generate an episodic memory. And this, they've got this sort of interesting idea of similar causation, that a process can sort of produce a very similar self-duplicating form of itself. So it can generate another episodic memory and another momentary one and another momentary one. And in appropriate circumstances, such as decisions to recall, it can generate a recollection. So it's got this idea that we can explain all of this in terms of momentary elements causally giving rise to other momentary elements. But they also, I mean, this is not something they argue, but it can allow for the possibility that episodic memories can shape. It's not like we have an impression of a past experience experience that's preserved through time, unchanging, and then it pops up later. In fact, because it's momentary and it's conditioned by what other processes are active, it can shift and change. And so this kind of analysis could account for why it is that episodic memories could change over time, even if they're not being recollected and then put back down. There's no persisting state, there's no persisting storage. What we have instead are just momentary psychological processes that are being generated and regenerated and prompted by other conditions to generate conscious experiences.
And just to be clear, the theories that we're talking about here, this is not a thing that exists out there in the world. It's just a sort of, according to the sort of Vasubandhu defense, it's a useful description. It's our way of organizing what's happening.
Yes. I mean, there can be a real asymmetry between the world that we experience and the ultimate reality that generates it. So the ultimate reality is momentary and dynamic. The way we experience has a more temporal extended duration. But there are different ways to explain why that is. So, you know, one question that comes up is, well, look, if everything is momentary in the way that you say, why is it that I seem to experience myself as a temporally extended person experiencing a temporally extended, you know, extended world? The stuff in front of me is not moving. It looks pretty stable. How do I account for this? And they have this complex story about how it is that representations, you know, arise really quickly and tend to blur together, and we use memory to unify similar-looking sensations with others and concepts to organize them into the idea of a stable object. But this can all be explained in terms of complex interactions between mental and psychological processes. We don't need to assume that there is an underlying unity that has to be there to account for this phenomena.
You mentioned agency earlier, which is a challenge for the reductionist view. First of all, how do you understand agency? And secondary to that, why is agency such a challenge for the reductionist view of the self?
The issue of agency is really difficult. This sort of raises the question of how can a view that only admits momentary processes and their causal interactions, how can it capture the kind of organized goal-directed activity we attribute to persons? And the worry here is whether a causal framework of just things arising from other things, can it really capture the kind of activity that we have that's, you know, making decisions, planning ahead. This doesn't seem to be just sequences of events. It looks like there's some structure and purposeness to it. And it's kind of difficult to think whether this is something that can be explained within a reductive framework. And it really matters in a Buddhist context how we explain this, because if there's no self, it looks like, well, there's no one who can perform actions and no one who experiences their effects. And, you know, if karma is a sort of the basis of moral significance of actions, it looks like we might be moving towards moral nihilism. So it's big deal for Buddhists to be able to account for how it is that we can make decisions for what we do and be karmically responsible for them. And now the reductionists do have a response to this. They're, on their view, an intention initiates a series of psychological and physical processes, which in the right kind of situation generates a karmic result. And this action isn't performed by the intention, but the intention kind of has to be supported by a whole range of different processes like bodily capacities, memory, conceptualization. But you might think, well, this might still not be enough to explain intentional action. I mean, intentional action seems to involve sort of the coordinated functioning of these processes. I mean, think of any kind of activity. The ones that are relevant to karma are sort of bad ones, like stealing and murdering and telling lies. An intention might be necessary for something to count as a lie rather than just an accidental misspeaking. And so the lie gets some worse bad karma than an accidental misspeak. But that's not going to be enough. You need a body to be able, you need a speech act. You need to be able to open your mouth. You need all kinds of things. And it's not enough to think of these as just events following each other. They have to be coordinated to generate the action of the lie. So what it looks like we need to explain is, how can these processes be coordinated together in a way that's directed towards a unified sort of purposive outcome? And I think a really nice way to think about it is just deliberative choice. It looks like any account of persons needs to be able to account for how it is we make decisions and make a choice. We weigh up options, we retain information about them, we set ourselves on a course of action, we change our minds. All of this seems to require a bit of sustained and coordinated patterns of activity. How can this be accounted for? So there is a real question whether or not the reductionist view has a causal framework that can explain this kind of interaction. And it's not clear that it does. I mean, on traditional accounts, they have quite a minimal view about causation. So, you know, causation is just a temporal succession, a linear succession of events and co-arising conditions at a given moment. But we might think this is just not enough to explain how complex activities are organized and sustained, whether it's intentional bodily action or purposive processes like growth and development.
Yeah, what's interesting here is that we can see a shift taking place in the debate from questions about the self to questions about complex systems and how they're organized. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, in the Buddhist discussion of this debate, the defender of the emergentist sort of proposes that what we need, in addition to causally interactive, you know, these momentary processes, is we need a real relational structure that will give us the functional unity we need to explain purposive action. But I'm not quite sure this solves the problem because, you know, a structural unity is not yet a functional unity. We need some account of how it is that these processes interact with each other in a way that generates coordinated activity. And that doesn't seem to be provided within the sort of the Buddhist debates. But I think it raises a real challenge for the reductionist position. How do we explain purposive functional activity within their causal framework? And I think when we're thinking about, well, what kind of causal organization do we need to be able to account for, I think it really helps to look at different forms of biological processes in the sciences.
Right, okay. Yeah, this is where you bring in, you know, biological regulation, feedback systems in the body. What do those show? What sort of light do they shed on the debate?
Yeah, so many of the features that we're trying to explain in terms of person, especially agency, involve forms of organizations. They're just not unique to persons, right? They're already present in biological systems. Coordination, regulation, goal-directed activity, they all show up in processes like growth, repair, and homeostasis. So I think if you sort of look at those cases, it gives us a clearer sense of what kind of organization needs to be explained. And I think a useful place to look is homeostatic regulation. Things like the way the body, you know, keeps a stable temperature and regulates blood sugar or, you know, repairs tissues after injury. What these systems show is it's not just coordination, but sort of a more complex kind of organization. Multiple processes, hormones, neural, cellular, they interact through feedback. And that means the system doesn't just move forward in a simple chain of causes and effects. Later states can influence earlier ones by feeding back into the system and then modifying how it behaves. And these processes also constrain one another. So what one part does depends on what the others are doing at the same time. So the behavior of the system is shaped by this ongoing interaction, not just by a linear sequence of events. And I think this matters for the broader philosophical view. So a minimal causal framework, where we're just thinking of one event giving rise to another, it can capture succession, but it struggles to capture this kind of non-linear, mutually constraining organization. So I think biological systems make the challenge very clear. The issue is not just how events follow each other, but how patterns of activity are structured and stabilized through feedback and interaction. And that's exactly the kind of organization we also see in agency. So the question is whether a reductionist framework that focuses on momentary processes and their local causal interactions can accommodate this kind of system-level explanation, or whether it needs to be expanded. And if it's expanded, does it bring it closer to the emergentist view that it opposes?
You have a really interesting paper from a couple of years back that looks at the idea of rebirth, and it asks what the Buddhist attitude to rebirth should be if we accept that rebirth is inconsistent with current science. And there's a form of Buddhist agnosticism that says, well, we can't be certain if rebirth is true, so we should therefore behave as if it were true, which is very interesting ethical terrain that we don't have time to cover here. But I'm wondering if there's a similar move to be made with regard to the self, like treating the unified self as a helpful metaphor whose actual reality or otherwise is less important than the ethical work it does in grounding things like responsibility and agency. Is that something that a reductionist and an emergentist could both agree on?
Look, I think so. So what the reductionist often does to try to explain system-level phenomena that involves complex relational structures is to say, well, this is just a matter of convention, a way that we describe more complex systems that are in fact independent and causally interacting. So they often use that move to explain why it is we can talk about persons and rebirth and these kind of phenomena. It's because they can be reductively explained in terms of these underlying processes. In some ways, I want to say that this doesn't solve the problem for them, right? The question at issue is kind of, well, can you account for these sort of complex purposive behaviours in terms of an ultimate ontology that only has these momentary events in causal connection? So that question still stands for the reductionist, even if they have the toolkit of conventional reality. They still need to account for that. But this machinery of conventional truth and reality can do a lot of stuff for the reductionist. So there's a really nice example that you get from the work of Mark Sideritz. He has this nice example of a soft drink machine. And he's like, is it conventionally true that there's a soft drink machine in the foyer or a teletransporter? He's like, how do we determine this? I mean, in one way, you might say, well, look, there's an ultimate reality, but in terms of convention, it's just however we want to think about it, whatever it's convenient. But there's got to be a way to sort out what's conventionally true and what's conventionally false. You don't want it to just be a matter of just arbitrary, this is how we happen to think about things conventionally. And so he thinks, well, actually, we can answer this question because, you know, the idea of a soft drink machine contains certain ideas about what you can do with it, right? A soft drink machine, you can press certain buttons, put some money in, and you'll get a soft drink out. A teletransporter, you push certain buttons and certain things happen and you end up somewhere else. We can test this. Once you press those buttons, do you end up somewhere else or do you get a soft drink? If you get a soft drink, then you don't have a teletransporter. Now, what makes this true? It's not because we happen to think that way. It might be useful to think that it's a teletransporter. What makes it true is the underlying machinery that makes this thing work. So he thinks this underlying ontology of ultimately real, causally interacting processes can function as sort of the justifying grounds that can sort out what of these conventional claims are true and which are false. So we can say it's conventionally true there's a soft drink machine, and we can form predictions. We can test it out. We can press the buttons and see if it does what we conventionally assume such things can do. And if it doesn't, then we're wrong and we should revise our beliefs. If it does what we think it could do, we can continue to believe in that way. But there's a way to adjudicate between what we think is conventionally real in more complex systems talk in terms of its relationship to what's really going on at an ultimate level. So the issue here, though, is that, well, what about persons? Because persons need to be able to form intentions, make plans, deliberate. Can we explain that in terms of just momentary processes and their causal interactions? And there's a genuine question about whether that's true or whether they have to assume that there's a kind of system-level organization amongst those processes to explain how this works. And so that's the challenge. And I think there's two strategies available for them to respond to this particular challenge. And I'm not quite sure which is the right way to go, but I think they have a couple of routes to take.
And what are they? What are those two routes?
So one option might be to say, well, look, complex activities like intentional action or biological regulation, they can be explained in terms of networks rather than just in terms of linear sequences. But I've come to think that if you push that strategy far enough, especially once you bring in feedback and mutual constraint, it starts to look like a form of weak emergence. You end up needing to appeal to system-level organization to explain how they function together, even if you don't posit something like a strongly emergent entity. And something like this tension is already visible in the ancient debates and in some contemporary literature. So the work of Varela and Evan Thompson and Eleanor Roche, The Embodied Mind, it's this kind of relation, this kind of mutually constraining thing that they say is evidence in Buddhism of emergence. So this kind of move really is a little bit more in favour of a kind of emergence and not quite what a reductionist might want. So what can a reductionist do? Like, are they stuffed? Is there any strategy available to them to deal with this? And I think there might be one way they can try to respond, which preserves their more minimal causal framework, but it appeals to resources it already has, because in this analysis, it's not simply that, you know, one cause generates another effect, but causes generate effects only when supported by a raft of co-arising conditions. So we might develop this idea of these supporting conditions into a network account of how they mutually, jointly shape the outcome of what comes up in the next moment in a series. So we can get an account of how ultimately real processes can constrain each other, but not in a way that they simultaneously cause each other to arise, but in a sense that causation involves a network of supporting conditions that constrain what occurs in the next moment. Now, the real challenge in thinking through is this a goer? Well, how does it account for non-linear feedback? I mean, I was describing biological processes. This still looks like a very linear story.
Yeah.
And I think, well, maybe they could reference back to this idea of causal inference that I mentioned before. They might say, well, look, at the conventional level, when we're talking about causal interactions in terms of systems, feedback does look circular, right? We have to assume a system and that this information goes back into it. But that doesn't mean causation is circular. What appears as feedback can be analyzed still as a sequence of forward-moving steps where earlier states condition later steps. It's only at a sort of a conventional level when we're talking about a system that it looks like it's circular, but at the the fine-grained analysis, it's still a linear sequence of causation. So maybe they could do something along those lines. And so here, cooperation is just more about how co-arising processes contribute their own, causal role. But the fact that other processes are arising at the same time plays some role about what happens next. An example that might illustrate it a bit is just, I mean, this comes up all the time in Buddhism, A spark generates a flame, but it doesn't do so unless there's also oxygen and fuel and other kinds of support conditions. Those other conditions can't generate a flame. You really need the spark. You really need that kind of friction. But you need supporting conditions for that effect. And if there were different supporting conditions, it would generate a different effect. So it's this kind of idea that we can get a more rich analysis of the kinds of, supporting system-like structure, a network of structure where there's more than one thing constraining what occurs in a system, but if we think of it in a sort of a dynamic sense rather than actually circular. Now, these moves, I think, go some way to capturing the phenomena, but the question is really whether it's enough. Like, can it really explain the kind of integrated system-level organization that we see, or whether at some point the explanation just implicitly relies on treating the system as a whole?
Yeah, and of course that's the question that we're going to have to leave spinning as we take our leave of this discussion. But I was going to finish by saying that it does seem to me that the more that reductionism stretches itself to accommodate the various philosophical objections to it, the more it starts to look like emergence. But what you're outlining there seems to be a sort of a philosophical strategy that avoids that problem, or at least makes it less obvious.
Yeah, so I'm actually sympathetic to a sort of a weaker deflationary kind of emergence. I don't think we need anything like strong emergent real networks, real systems. But I think we do need a system level, we need to take that kind of issue seriously if we're trying to explain coordinated goal-directed activity. But at the same time, I'm kind of keen to explore whether these phenomena could be accounted for within a sort of sophisticated reductionism. I mean, after all, there's a long history of reductionisms eventually triumphing over apparent emergentism. So I suspect at the end of the day, there might be some account of how a richer, more structured network of causal conditions might be able to address some of these issues. But for me, it remains an open question.
Mm-hmm.
But what I find really exciting is I think there are resources to support both options within Buddhist philosophy traditions. I mean, they have their respective costs, and maybe in the end of the day we want to draw on different Buddhist traditions to get better answers. But I find it really striking and exciting to see that these issues are debated in quite sophisticated ways amongst Buddhists in classical India, and that they have arguments that might, support both of the competing options that are currently being disputed in contemporary biology. I mean, the organization of complex systems, whether they should be understood in reductive or emergentist terms, these aren't just modern or Western concerns, but they have deep roots in ancient Asian intellectual traditions.
So there's more to talk about, and we'll have to get you back on to talk about it. How long do you think it's going to take you to figure this out?
Well, let's keep going. We could have this conversation for a couple of decades, I'm sure.
Right. It's going to be the 10-year special podcast version. All right, well, Bronwyn, it's been great to talk. Thank you so much for your time. It's a very interesting discussion. It's been great to have you on the show.
Oh, I've enjoyed it a lot. Thank you so much.
Bronwyn Finnegan. She's an associate professor in the School of Philosophy at the Australian National University in Canberra, and she's been my guest this week in the Philosopher's Zone. More information on the website, more Philosopher's Zone episodes available for streaming or download any old time via ABC Listen, and I hope you can join me for more Philosopher's Zone next week. The Philosopher's Zone is produced by me, David Rutledge, on the lands of the Bundjalung people. See you next time.